puzzle, the transformative power of an insight. And our panelists today include Stephen Taft, Stephen Sklar, and Sue Peters, and we appreciate everybody coming in. This is our third panel for today. We got one more after this, and it's one coming after is called the Public Money System, which they're all exciting. But so far, we've had we had some good attendance. We had a lot of interest. Probably the interest was exceeding the number of participants, but I think overall it's a positive event.
He's next door.
Oh, I think that's where I'm supposed to be.
125.
Which one are you looking for, John?
Yeah.
He's at 121.
Oh, okay, right down here. Thank you.
So let me introduce the panel. So why don't we just
kick it off and
see where we go.
Okay.
So see what kind of questions we get.
Okay. I had anticipated I'm Steve Sklar. I had anticipated saying to kick this off, just in case we didn't get, you know, fill the room. I want to thank you both for coming. but seriously, okay. So we're talking about this is kind of a basics overview of Henry George's thinking. Lately, I've been teaching a course at the Henry George School, and I want to concentrate most specifically on the problem that Henry George sort of set his life to trying to solve. And his basic insights, what I call his central insight, and as the title of the session says, the transformative power of an insight. So as I do when I teach my course on the science of political economy, I'll start by saying that on my walk over here of a little over a mile and a half from Penn Station, I passed about 10 or 11 people who were begging or sleeping on the street. The most sort of memorable sighting of that type that I had was there was a guy who was literally sleeping on the sidewalk. He had a hat, like a baseball cap, but it was off his head, and he was sleeping with his face actually on the sidewalk. I mean, what has to happen to your life that you're sleeping on concrete in that way? In 1869, when Henry George came to New York City from San Francisco, where he lived at the time, he saw pretty much the same thing. And he was struck and sort of astonished to consider that, you know, literally cheek by jowl with great wealth that you could only see in a great city, he saw the most extreme poverty. And this deepened his interest in a question that he had been interested in earlier, which is what I call the poverty problem. And the way he thought about it was this: how could it be, you know, how is it that poverty persists, and not only persists, but deepens as civilizations progress and advance in their ability to produce wealth? When he went back to San Francisco after his trip to New York, and in 1870, he basically, because he had been so intrigued by this in New York, he had what I call his central insight. I'll read you from a biography where he actually is quoted talking about that. The time is, as I say, 1870, not that long after the end of the Civil War. The place is the hills outside of San Francisco. Basically, the Transcontinental Railroad has just been completed, and with that, the closing of the American frontier. And George, you know, and with all of that, the land values in the San Francisco area have skyrocketed. George has gone out riding and remembers the revelatory moment this way. Absorbed in my own thoughts, he says, I had driven the horse into the hills until he panted. Stopping for breath, I asked a passing teamster, for want of something better to say, what land was worth there. He pointed to some cows grazing off so far that they looked like mice and said, I don't know exactly, but there is a man over there who will sell some land for $1,000 an acre, which in those days was a huge sum. Like a flash, it came upon me that there was the reason of advancing poverty with advancing wealth. With the growth of population, land grows in value, and the men who work it must pay more for their privilege. I turned back amidst quiet thought to the perception that then came to me and has been with me ever since. So what comes to George in that moment is the idea that the growing prosperity of the San Francisco area has mostly benefited not the people of that area on the whole, but the owners of land there. And, you know, getting on to the transformative power of this central insight, I mean, it really changed his life. Before this insight happens, George is, you know, he's an industrious, competent, venturesome young man. He starts his working life working on merchant ships as a cabin boy and such, travels the world a bit, becomes a prospector during the gold rush days in California. He learns the printer's trade, works a little bit in publishing, and starts a newspaper. He had, you know, gained a little bit of local recognition for his editorial writing. He had some writing ability. He got positive feedback for a letter that he sent to John Stuart Mill, but for the most part, he's not particularly well known. Flash forward to after the insight, it changes his life. As he says, it's a perception that's been with him ever since. He ends up writing in 1879 his major work, which is a best known work, Progress and Poverty. And between that and other books that he's written, they end up, you know, selling and being distributed in the millions, probably over 5 million copies, which even to this day is probably a body of work that's, you know, the bestseller in the economics area, although strangely he's hardly known today. But back in the day, he was all the rage. He goes around debating publicly, both in person and in writing, prominent figures of his day, the Pope Leo. He debates the Duke of Argyll, a prominent landowner, and other people. He attracts to himself followers of leading figures. Leo Tolstoy was an admirer. Albert Einstein was an admirer. The young Clarence Darrow got his career started speaking at a Henry George rally. The young Winston Churchill was an admirer, though he veered away from George's ideas. Sun Yat-sen, a statesman who was revered both in later the People's Republic of China as well as Taiwan, and so on. And in back in the day, both in George's lifetime particularly, and in the earlier parts of the 20th century, he's kind of a worldwide household name, although it's interestingly, he's almost forgotten by most of the public today. But back in the day, he was quite the thing in economics. He ran twice for the mayoralty of New York, almost won, I think, the first time around, but could only be defeated by his opponents, who included Teddy Roosevelt, throwing their support, their voters together to combine to defeat him. So the transformative power of an insight, this was a transformation for George. Turning to his effect on other people, like, for example, me. So I'm kind of an odd duck, as many of us who call ourselves Georges are, and maybe every person in the world. But what I mean by that is my father taught the Henry George course on Progress and Poverty at the George School years ago for 17 years. So I was kind of brought up on it when I was a young man. I've come back to it recently, having read his works over the years, occasionally, kind of galvanized to get involved and start teaching at the George School by the election of Donald Trump, where I felt like I had to do something to get these ideas out. So the effects of George's insight were, you know, had a ripple effect on a lot of people. He was ironically kind of bigger in other countries than his native United States, Canada, particularly British Columbia, Vancouver, Australia, Ireland, England. The early utopian socialists were sort of fascinated by George, George Bernard Shaw, and so on. Turning to what more detail about his insights, let's pause for a second and consider what it is that he attempted to do, and if you follow him, he claimed to do, and you may believe that he succeeded. But is it really possible that the field of economics, which was once called political economy, really can yield the kind of insight into patterns that govern the workings of the economic world on anything similar to a scientific level of insight? I mean, if you consider the multiplicity of the economic universe, it's not immediately apparent that the attempt even is sensible to try. So where does George get off claiming that he's had this insight, and how did he, get such a following? So I like to use a sort of analogy to describe what it is he claims to have achieved by turning to classical science, something we can all agree easily is a science, astronomy. So back in the day, for hundreds of years, ancient astronomers would look at the heavens and they would see what we call the fixed stars moving in a fixed pattern across the sky at night. The constellations basically don't change their relationship to each other. And it was easy for the ancients and sensible for them to think that the Earth was the center of the universe and the heavens with the stars moved as a kind of spherical shell around us. But there was the problem of the planets. Planets, bright points of light in the night sky that will move across the sky in one direction, then double back, and then double back again in a pattern called retrograde motion. This kind of messed up this easy theory about what the heavens were doing. So it was the problem of explaining planetary motion. And the planets, of course, are named after the word planetos in Greek, which means wanderer. So the ancients, like Ptolemy, who was a great astronomer, theorized that the planets made curlicues. There were sort of elaborate sort of clockwork mechanism to preserve the view that the Earth was the center of the universe. It was not until, I think it was the 1600s, when you had a number of people, Tycho Brahe, a Dane, Kepler, a great German mathematician, analyzing in detail, careful analysis of the motion of the planets, where Kepler then came up with his three laws of planetary motion, which ultimately ended up in the revelation that the planets actually, the Earth is not the center of the universe or even the solar system, but the Earth is a planet like other planets. And as we all know, they move in elliptical orbits around the sun, with the sun at one focal point. And then building on that, you had Isaac Newton develop his laws of not just of planetary motion, but of motion both on Earth and in the heavens, the most spectacular of which was his law of gravitation, which related the force of gravity between any bodies to their relative masses, the size of their masses, and the distance between them. So this is sort of classic science. What George claims to have done through the course of his life and his writing is to discover on a similar footing the patterns of how the natural world works, natural law, universal law, governing basic phenomena in the economic sphere. And he does this in a number of ways. But I'll start with just sort of stating what he claims to have investigated or discovered, in some cases building on the work of other people. He's particularly focused in his writing and his thinking, because he had a gift for clear thinking, on the importance of defining key terms clearly and using them consistently, something that he criticizes his forebears for not always doing. So for example, he defines the science of political economy, the thing that he's going to be looking into, as the investigation of the production of wealth and its distribution in social or civilized life. And he immediately turns to the fact that wealth is therefore an extremely important term to that science. So he defines wealth as natural objects, so moved, altered, combined, and so forth, to better fit them for the satisfaction of human desires. And he points out early in his sort of thinking that this is a crucial thing right there. And it all goes back to his central insight. Because, as he points out, other writers and thinkers in political economy had sometimes included land in the definition of wealth and other times not. And by defining wealth the way George does, he gets at the central importance of the role of land ownership in the workings of the economy. He defines capital as a species of wealth. Wealth that is not used immediately to gratify human desires, but is held or stored or used for the production of more wealth. So those are some basics. And I'll just mention some of his methods of how he likes to conduct his investigation. One thing he's particularly good at is what could be called the reduction to absurdity, and also the use of thought experiment. If we pause for a second and think about how odd that is in something calling itself a science in economics, classical vision that we have, the image of a scientist is somebody in a white lab coat, able to control conditions physically and eliminate variables so that you can study the effect of on one particular thing of changes in conditions that you can control. And George points out that it's difficult or impossible to do that in economics where you're dealing with human beings and societies. But what you can do, a powerful tool to him, is thought experiment, imaginative experiment as he calls it, to consider a simplified situation and in imagination changing different variables to see what the effect would be on them. And that may seem a little ridiculous when you think about, you know, classical science. I mean, what? No equipment, no lab coat. But consider for the moment that one of his great admirers, Albert Einstein, in fact is regarded rightly as one of our greatest theoretical physicists and was a big user of thought experiments. So maybe it shouldn't be dismissed that carefully. So I'd like to just read you a sort of combination of a kind of thought experiment. And it also indicates George's great talent for reducing certain theories of the day to absurdity. This is from his book, Protection or Free Trade. And he's talking about what you'll probably recognize this as a kind of theory that persists today. What he's specifically talking about in what I'm going to read you is the notion in trade policy that encouraging manufacturing is crucially important to trying to make an economy prosper. I mean, he understands the importance of manufacturing, but he's illustrating in what I'm about to read you that the flaw in the thinking about it for policy formation is that it puts a cause and effect, it reverses the order. In logic, it's called, I guess, post hoc ergo propter hoc. It's kind of confusing the sequence logically of what's going on. But let me just read. So he says, imagine a village of, say, 100 voters. Imagine two of these villagers I'm sorry, I'm reading you the wrong thing. Yeah, let me get the right one, okay. Rewind. Here we go. He says, talking about the idea of the importance of theaters. Here we go. He said the manufacturing argument goes this way. Manufacturing countries are always rich countries. Countries that produce only raw materials are always poor. Therefore, people have reasoned, if we would be rich, we must have manufacturers. And in order to get manufacturers, we must encourage them through various trade policies. To many, this argument seems plausible, especially as the taxes for the encouragement of the protected industries are levied in such a way that their payment is not immediately seen. He says, but I could make as good an argument to the people of the little town of Jamaica, Queens, near which I am now living, in support of a subsidy to a theater. I could say to them, all large cities have theaters, and the more theaters it has, the larger the city. Look at New York. New York has more theaters than any other city in America, and is consequently the greatest city in America. Philadelphia ranks next to New York in the number and size of its theaters, and therefore comes next to New York in population and wealth. So throughout the country, wherever you find large, well-appointed theaters, you will find large and prosperous towns, while where there are no theaters, the towns are small. Is it any wonder that Jamaica is so small and grows so slowly when it has no theaters at all? People do not like to settle in a place where they cannot occasionally go to the theater. If you want Jamaica to thrive, you must take steps to build a fine theater, which will attract a large population. Look at Brooklyn. Brooklyn was only a small riverside village before its people had the enterprise to start a theater. And see now, since they have begun to build theaters, how large a city Brooklyn has become. And then he goes on, he says, I could drop into statistics and show, you know, how theaters have exist, you know, with great prosperity in cities. I could use a historical argument about the theaters in the ancient times and who prospered, who had great theaters. I could talk to about Salt Lake City that built a spacious theater. And, you know, these people are just wicked polygamists, and look how prosperous they are. If that wouldn't convince people, I could talk about, he says, if such an argument would not induce the Jamaicans to tax themselves to encourage a theater, would it not at least be as logical as arguments that have induced the American people to tax themselves to encourage manufacturers? The truth is that manufacturers, like theaters, are the result, not the cause, of the growth of population and wealth. Okay, you know, just a good example of his, the way his mind works, and the way his advocacy writing works. He can be pretty punchy when he wants to be. I'll give you one other example that I want to read, and then we'll push on.
So New York's population should grow because of Hamilton.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly, and it's all, you know, it's like, but George is basically saying, yes, I mean, manufacturers are manufacturing, and in the prosperity of manufacturing is a sign of a great developed civilization. But to encourage it through various types of tariffs is putting the cart before the horse. It's flawed reasoning. Okay. So what he says is, and this has to do with, well, you'll recognize the theory if I read this. Imagine a village of, say, 100 voters. Here he's talking here, he's addressing the policy, the trade policy argument, which he's obviously against, that it's crucially helpful to develop certain industries because that will make other industries that use them prosperous, and eventually the particular industries that benefit from certain tariffs, that benefit will be widespread throughout society. This is the country that imposes the tariffs. He says, imagine a village of, say, 100 voters. Imagine two of these villagers to make such a proposition as this. We are desirous, fellow citizens, of seeing you more prosperous, and to that end, propose this plan. Give us the privilege of collecting a tax of 5 cents a day from everyone in the village. No one will feel the tax much, for even to a man with a wife and 8 children, it will come only to the paltry sum of 50 cents a day. Yet this slight tax will give our village two rich citizens who can afford to spend money. We will at once begin to live in commensurate style. We will enlarge our houses and improve our grounds, set up carriages, hire servants, give parties, and buy much more freely at the stores. This will make trade brisk and cause a greater demand for labor. This in turn will create a greater demand for agricultural productions, which will enable the neighboring farmers to make a greater demand for store goods and the labor of mechanics. Thus shall we all become prosperous. Then he says, mark this, there is no country under the sun, a village in which the people would listen to such a proposition. Yet it is every whit as plausible as the doctrine that encouraging some industries encourages all industries. So I put it to you, maybe that was plausible in Georgia State to say there's no country in the world that would listen to such a proposition. But I put it to you, we are certainly such a country, at least in the era of Reagan and whoever you want to name. This is the trickle-down theory. If the economic policy is proposed by people who directly benefit from that taxation at the expense of other people, then the theory is at least suspect along the lines of this reduction to absurdity. We could get into it further, but the point I'm making in bringing this up is this is the way George's mind and ability to communicate his thinking, one of the methods he uses to devastating effect. It would probably not have been a lot of fun to be on the other side of a debate with this guy. Okay. So, moving on here, I'm just going to hit main points so I get time for us to do discussion. So he defines wealth, he defines capital, he defines land. He's particularly gifted at using a well-chosen analogy or an illustrative example. I'll read you one more, and then I'll take a little break for discussion. And then I have a couple more points, and I'll bring in Sue. And of course, Steve Taft is here partly to look pretty, which he does, I think you'll agree, to devastating effect. But he may even chime in. We won't know until we get there. Okay. Right. So I just want to grab something here. We're talking about, all right, near the beginning of protection or free trade. Another great example of George's, sort of nuggets of insight that shine through his choice of sort of well-chosen imagery or analogy, metaphor. The beginning of protection or free trade again. He says, near the window by which I write, a great bull is tethered by a ring in his nose. Grazing round and round, he has wound his rope about the stake until now he stands a close prisoner, tantalized by rich grass he cannot reach, unable to even toss his head to rid him of the flies that cluster on his shoulders. Now and again he struggles vainly and then, after pitiful bellowings, relapses into silent misery. This bull, a very type of massive strength, who, because he is not wit enough to see how he might be free, suffers want in sight of plenty, and is helplessly preyed upon by weaker creatures, seems to me no unfit emblem of the working masses. And then he goes on to talk about, in all lands, people are having difficulty often making a living, and they spasmodically struggle and cry out. But until they trace effect to cause, until they see how they are fettered and how they might be freed, their struggles and outcries are as vain as those of the bull. I'll end it there. But, and then he goes on to talk about, the thing is to think clearly so that you can analyze the problem. But I think it's a powerful emotional sort of an image. So what I think I'll do is just pause there. If anybody has any comments, whether you guys or people in the room, about, let's consider a couple of elements of what I've mentioned, elements of George's thinking. I mean, I'll just put this out as a sort of rhetorical question for any response you have, semi-rhetorical. I mean, again, think of economics, the charts, the graphs, the differences in fortune that we have as individuals, the things that can make us prosperous at times and threaten us economically. I mean, can it really be that you could have an insight that would lead to an understanding of the workings of the economic world the way we understand the physical sciences? I just throw that out to you. I mean, at a very, very minimum, does that not seem really weird? You know, how could that be? Any thoughts? Any reactions?
I thought it was interesting to bring in Albert Einstein because he did read and appreciate Henry George. So it's interesting to explore the idea of what it takes to conceive of a science or a breakthrough, because I guess people see Einstein as achieving some breakthroughs. But it's kind of like the what comes first. It's conceiving what truth is and then come up with a mathematical model, or the other way. Because often I see the example of mathematics being used to justify something that's not really that clear, so you do the math to say, damn it, there it is. You know, and I'm thinking that it's almost like beside the point. You know, I have to convince people of the truthfulness of what it is, and you know, the math is just secondary.
Well, I have two thoughts about that, one from a Georgist point of view and the other an engineering point of view. So George himself felt that economics, as it came to be called, used to be called political economy, had kind of gone down the wrong path in becoming too focused for his money on statistics and mathematical analysis and not enough on primary dynamics and the use of terms and concepts. So that's one point that sort of complements what you're saying. The other thing is, now, if I remember correctly, you're an engineer, or you have an engineering background. So you probably will probably both agree that, you know, the design of an engineering project and the use of whatever math you need to support that is never going to be stronger than the basic understanding of the forces and the structure at the beginning design phase. You can use all the math you want, but if you've got a bad idea, your building may fall down. So, sure. I mean, so I you know, but basically the strange thing, you know, what you'll encounter, if we discuss George's ideas or any economics outside this room or maybe in the room, is, you know, resistance to the idea that some of these insights that George characterizes his thinking. How is that even possible? Because economics is inherently necessarily much too complicated to have, you know, relatively simple concepts that get at truth. I mean, I have a good friend who I went to college with who's brilliant mathematically. I mean, he used to bring home all kinds of commendations. He's worked in statistics. He read the Introduction to Progress and Poverty, and he couldn't get past it because he felt like it's just too simple. You were going to say something.
I was going to say that George wrote for the ordinary person because his concern was very much for the condition of labor, and that's the perspective he takes throughout all his writings. So when you started with the observation of the homeless people, it's that audience for whom George wrote. That why was that problem exist? So he's very much a humanitarian, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, absolutely. And so he abhorred, actually, academia. He had no time for them, whatever.
Yeah.
Everything is addressed to the general public.
Yes.
Now, the ideas that George presented are actually not unique, right? In the span of human history, we had funded many things, and land was held in common. Native Americans held land in common. Many societies held land in common,
mm-hmm.
right? It was the problem was it was a taking of people's resources, started with, I mean, we can look at many points, but I suppose in the Western world, the foreclosure acts that were passed in England kicked people off the land with about the same time the Industrial Revolution began, about 1760, right? So
mm-hmm.
there were rough timeline like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it was for those people that George had a very genuine concern. And and he's trying to lift their conditions. Same ethos permeates protection of free trade, or what's in the best interest of labor, not of industry, but of labor, right? And that's for what we cared about. Mm-hmm. I just want to make one other little comment, and I'll shut up, is that you had said George is little known today. Actually, I would dispute that with you for a very long time.
I'm George very happy, by
very
the way, to
well
hear
known.
That.
Yeah. My colleague over here has yes. probably done more to collect land value taxation than many, 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 many readings of things. He has trained many of the Latin American people who are increasingly turning to land value taxation to raise revenue in their communities. Even here, New York State budget has a facility now for land value capture. Okay, we are not calling it Henry George every second sentence, but the plan is definitely there. I mean, most of a big bunch of the tube in London was funded by land value capture. I mean, the whole idea has spread everywhere, right? And people recognize it as.
I can't tell you how happy I am to be corrected on this. Between you and Marty's, what sometimes seems to me to be insane level of optimism, it's very refreshing for it to hear this. So, from your mouth to God's ear, and whoever you are, thanks a lot. Tell me your name.
Nubaldo Aguilera.
Nubaldo?
Nubaldo.
Nubaldo. Okay. Con mucho gusto. And thank you. Tell me your name.
I'm Billy.
Billy. Okay. I've seen your posts on email stuff.
If you touch something about me, I want to reinforce some
yes.
of the wonderful exposition that you made, the connection, the influence through the world. But you forgot one point that is remarkable mm-hmm. as a Latino. Jose Figueres, from the father of the Jose Figueres, president of the Latin decade, was president for 3 terms in Costa Rica from 1948 to whatever. Mm-hmm. And he took classes with Henry George in Spanish here in 1945
ah.
in so New York.
What's interesting is he may have even studied with
and
people that my parents.
As a consequence of that,
yeah.
maybe your father was
well,
the teacher.
My father was later, but yeah. but his mentor might have been.
Probably.
Yeah.
And the other important thing is when he got the power, become president, he was a little short civil war because there is fraud from the conservative people there in Costa Rica, but he was successful. Mm. And he never denied that he was Georgist. And he eliminated the army because the budget was not enough to have the the army mm-hmm. in Costa Rica. Mm-hmm. And he declared the land value taxation. Mm-hmm. And the history, no history book talk about that. The biography of Henry George or the Henry George movement are not taking in consideration that important thing that happened in our backyard.
It may be that the biographers who would certainly have been sympathetic to know this were simply ignorant of Latin American developments.
Yeah, and secondly, I was the instructor of the General Council of the United Nations of sent to take classes for Jose Figueres' son. Mm. Sent to take classes with me in 1998, around there when I was a real militant.
How long did the land value tax stay in effect?
Well, in some way I've been fighting to keep it and they become very green, you know, accommodating with the modern time, the post-modernity, and the protection of the United States as a no virtual enemy, another Fidel Castro or Chavez. I've been a very intelligent conversation with the United States to keep the same status quo with some modification, but More than that, I don't know. My area of expertise is not precisely Latin America, it's Africa and Asia, but that is only a point of little reference.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. Thank you for that. I'll have to look for it.
Yeah.
Of course, we also just on that point, have spent a lot of resources educating people from Ecuadorian.
The fact is, we may not have that many people in the room, but who we have is choice.
Yeah.
So, let's just keep that in mind. You know?
Yeah.
All right.
We are proselytizing this stuff.
Yeah. Okay.
I've got an interesting story.
Yes, please.
So, for the last couple of weeks, I've been out Union Square passing out flyers for the June 9th event that I'm going to be in. And I ran into a guy from Uruguay, and he's a Georgist. Just happened to be there. He's going back home, but I told him to watch it on YouTube. But it's just interesting that randomly you can
right
get people.
Well, I mean, it's the same in every area of life. You know, I've gotten obsessed with soccer at a certain point. Now I'm doing group improv, and you know, the minute you're sort of into something, not that you just became interested, but it's like you have an antennae that pick up on, you know, kindred souls. It's kind of interesting how that happens.
And just to point out, not to belabor the point, but it's both on left and right sides of the spectrum that they refer to LBT. I mean, Milton Friedman believed it was the best tax, right? And even socialist people will also go for it. So it's kind of, you know, neutral.
That's the point Steve made in the first panel, that is a kind of politically neutral thinking, in a sense. Although, of course, it has political ramifications that can draw forth, by the same token, antagonism from both sides of the political spectrum. But we won't go there because I don't want to ruin the lovely optimism that floats now in this room. Okay. So the next point I wanted to make is that George, as good as he, you know, so if his central insight is that the progress in civilization and the ability to produce wealth gets siphoned off unjustly, as he would say, into the value of land and the pockets of private holders of great and valuable tracts of land, his further insight is that, therefore, we have to undo the policy that hasn't existed forever, but that has come to exist in the modern world of private property and land. Through the mechanism he proposes is the single tax, so that the community can basically collect what's called economic rent, that particular value that obtains because of the value of land in a community. So great, okay, and as I was indicating, and I'm probably preaching to the converted for the most part, George was, I think, had a gift, if you read his writing across his books, for a clear-headed thought of a type that is rare to encounter. I mean, it's true that there's a little barrier for some people to read his writings because it's kind of in 19th century prose. I think it stands the test of time very well, but it's different from the modern style of writing slightly in the sense that sentences tend to be longer in structure and have more clauses to them. But even accounting for that, the man was gifted in so many areas. Some of his sort of asides and incidental comments are worth reading in and of themselves, even if they're not on the economic point. But another thing that I want to mention, which you touched on, Billy, is that he's all about morality, even though he has a gift for objective intellectual thought. I mean, his emphasis is always comes back to his conviction that not just that there's poverty in the world and there shouldn't be, and why is that, but that poverty is a bad thing. Not everybody feels that way. Probably everybody at the forum here feels that way, but there are people that I've met in life who feel that, you know, people are poor because they bring it on themselves. So be it. That's the will of nature. And the thing is to get yourself out of poverty, kind of a dog-eat-dog view. But that's not George's view. So I'm going to read just a little paragraph where he talks in social problems, you know, and the point here is that George, speaking of left and right, can be, particularly I think on the right, I sense that he can be end up being co-opted and sort of adopted, I think in a wrongful way, to further an agenda that is not that humanitarian or compassionate, in a way that I think is a bad distortion of what he's all about. But if you read his writing, he you know, so for example, I think there's a strain of people across the Motley Crue, that is people attracted to George, of thinking that George is really all about doing away entirely with government and interference in economics. And I don't think that's entirely true. I think he's in favor of government interference where it is needed to prevent wrongful monopoly in utilities and other areas. But anyway, just to read this paragraph that kind of gets at that, and then I have another insight sort of my own in a way. In Social Problems, he says that he who produces should have, that he who saves should enjoy, is consistent with human reason and with the natural order. And as an aside, again, somebody who's on the political right could look at that, stop there, and say, look, see, he's all in favor of, you know, no government interference with the distribution of wealth or the production of wealth. But he goes on to say, but existing inequalities of wealth cannot be justified on this ground. As a matter of fact, how many great fortunes can be truthfully said to have been fairly earned? How many of them represent wealth produced by their possessors or those from whom their present possessors derive them? Did there not go to the formation of all of them something more than superior industry and skill? Such qualities may give the first start, but when fortunes begin to roll up into millions, there will always be found some element of monopoly, some appropriation of wealth produced by others. Often there is a total absence of superior industry, skill, or self-denial, and merely better luck or greater unscrupulousness. So I want to just get to one other point, then we'll stop for some discussion again. Shortly after the election of Donald Trump, when he was elected, I was sort of mulling over how he could be so popular among a base that you would think would naturally not put their political faith in a man who was well known to have never, you know, been statesmanlike, never shown any business or personal interest in helping the fortunes of society or other people other than Donald Trump, as far as we know, self-claimed billionaire, although who knows, because he inflates every claim, but let's give it to him that he's wealthy, a landlord. This doesn't seem to be the natural savior of some of the, you know, arguably disenfranchised components of society that are said to be his supporters. And then I happened, because I was teaching a mini course on protection or free trade, to run across a section that to me partly explained how this paradox could come to be. And it has to do with George's insight about the perspective about employers and employment from the point of view of laborers. He basically says, in our modern civilization, the masses of men possess only the power to labor. It is true that labor is the producer of all wealth in the sense of being the active factor of production. But it is useless without the no less necessary passive factor, meaning land. With nothing to exert itself upon, labor can produce nothing and is absolutely helpless. And so the men who have nothing but the power to labor must, to make that power of any use to them, either hire the material necessary to the exertion of labor, or as is the prevailing method in our industrial organization, sell their labor to those who have the material. So skipping ahead, hence arises the feeling that the man who employs another to work is a benefactor to him, a feeling which even the economists who have made war upon some of the popular delusions growing out of it have done their best to foster by teaching that capital employs and maintains labor, which George disagrees with. But there is that theory. This feeling runs through all classes and colors, all our thought and speech. One cannot read our newspapers without seeing that the notice of a new building or projected enterprise of any kind usually concludes by stating that it will give employment to so many men, as though the giving of employment, the privilege, the providing of work, were the measure of its public advantage and something for which all should be grateful. This feeling strong among employed is stronger still among employers. The rich manufacturer or iron worker or shipbuilder, or I would say landlord, talks and thinks of the men to whom he has, quote, given employment as though he had actually given something which entitled him to their gratitude. And he is inclined to think, and in most cases does think, that in combining to demand higher wages or less hours or in any way endeavoring to put themselves in the position of freely contracting parties, they are snapping at the hand that has fed them, although the obvious fact is that such an employer's men have given him a greater value than he has given them, else he could not have grown rich by employing them. So basically he's saying that the laboring classes in the current condition of society can come to regard the employer who Trump associates himself with as like the sun, the giver of all life. George does not see the production of wealth that way, but it at least partly explained this otherwise paradoxical phenomenon of the ascension of a Donald Trump on the votes of people who you would normally think would not regard him as a potential savior. So I'll just pause there before my final stuff to see if anybody wants to, I'm sorry to do this because we've had a Trump-free day until now, but it's very hard to do that. But if anybody wants to just throw anything at that spiel, go ahead.
Okay, well, there was a similar effect when we elected Mike Bloomberg as mayor. It's like, oh, we need somebody who understands economics or something like that, or maybe something will rub off and we'll all be better. And I guess I'm kind of pleased to some extent that de Blasio has been there for a while, and it seems like we're doing okay. So the myth that we need a rich guy to shake the stick at people is kind of crazy.
Yeah, it is crazy. Isn't it? It's just totally strange.
And being a city employee, I didn't get any raises until de Blasio came. I have a special reason to
really make.
I'm glad you admitted that.
This is not exactly to the Trump point, but I want to ask you two guys a question. Is there, as you perceive it, a difference in the cultures where a land value tax is being better received versus places where it's not? In other words, are there pre-existing economic conditions that make a country more open to receiving a land value tax message, or is it just in the messaging of the idea, or how do you see that?
Cuba is desperate for knowledge, Cuba, in this moment. They are willing to apply whatever new idea are coming in economics. They don't want to embrace neoliberal policies. But George's is the time for Cuba in this historical moment of transformation.
Were there other ideas that entered into the Cuban discussion and land value tax won out? Or
we sent the paper with the ideas of George. Precisely the person in charge was when under minister of economics there. The last, no relationship with me, but the last name, the same last name, Aguilera, is a lady. And she was fascinating, and she was waiting to be visited for us. And I was afraid to go there for, I'm not going to explain the reason of this season, but I did it. I transferred my knowledge to the leader in the school, and was not taken seriously more than something very trivial,
mm-hmm.
but was serious. They were impacted for the paper that we submit to them.
Do you think the moment has passed, or is there still potential?
I am not, in this moment, I am not close to the reality of Cuba. I don't know what is going on there, who is the real power. In that time, Fidel was still in power. I am talking about 10 years ago, mm-hmm. 12 years ago. And but now I'm a little disconnected. I don't know if my Aguilera person there is the minister. I have to do research for the school or somebody has to do research.
Can you speak for England? made it receptive?
I'm going to speak for the world in general. I think
even better. Why not? Well,
there's our right.
Yeah.
What I was going to say was that if you look at where LBT has some impact, you can start with Hong Kong and Singapore as two countries that fund themselves quite substantially from value taxation, right? Singapore a little different from Hong Kong, but they're both very progressive economies, right? Here, I think we have an issue of indoctrination. I don't like to use that word, but I can't think of a better one just now. Now, we glorify the entrepreneur, right? So we glorify Bloomberg, yeah, and we glorify Trump, exactly the same kind of thing. And does capital employ labor, does labor employ capital, has been another thing that's been glorified in our public policy, even to the extent that the entrepreneur attracts significant tax breaks. Capital itself, if you have to choose between hiring a machine and hiring a person, the public policy pushes definitely to the machine, even though at one point we say, well, we want more people working, right? I mean, you if you get this thing, what's the robot they manufacture up in Massachusetts, Baxter. Baxter is $25,000 out of the box, and he can do quite reasonable tasks. Okay, if you buy that as a small business, you can take it straight off your taxes. If you hire an employee at $25,000 salary, you're going to have to pay FICA on top of that, or FUTA, all of the charges, and why would you want to do this? So we've glorified capital at the expense of labor, and we don't talk about the natural resources being public property. Now, it arises sometimes when issues like water come up, right, which people can really identify with as being a public issue, right? So Flint and Nestle in New Hampshire and places like that become cause celebs, you know, we gotta fix this. But when you ask people about the natural resources and take them through the line that all wealth comes from the land, then people's perception of the thing, whether there should be, as you mentioned before, private property in land, it gets cast into doubt.
Well, and as George points out, one reason, there are two reasons for that resistance that you can think of. First, the great vested interest in, powerful people who own a lot of land, who have a lot of political influence and control, you know, probably media and academia and so on. But the second thing is that the common man, you know, the small guy, who has, you know, maybe owns his house or a small plot of land, has a stake in private land ownership, which, you know, may give that person of feeling like, well, this is sacred. How can you attack that property right? It's kind of interesting because I don't think that was the kind of land holding that George was against. You know, the person who uses a small amount of land or land in a thorough way to be productive or whatever is not, to him, the great enemy. It's the, you know, the mega landlord who owns one or more city blocks or who owns, you know, half of a state. You know, that's the danger. It's not this or that guy who owns a house, but this or that guy who owns a house could be resistant and easily influenced to resist the larger policy.
Yeah, I'm sorry, you're not done yet. You're speaking for the world, after all.
Yes.
So England has the same capital idolatry as we do, right?
Nice.
So how did the message crack into there to fund the subway?
Well, I can't, honestly, I don't know enough to answer that question thoroughly, but there's certain concepts in society that still exist. For example, the right to roam, you can Google that term, the right to roam is that if you happen to have a farm and you have to make your space available for ramblers, these are people who want to travel the countryside and so forth. In Ireland we have the same system. And it was actually reinforced in England, I think in 2002, something like that, I don't remember. So it's an acknowledgement that the public has an interest in the natural resources, right? So you have to do it. You can't just walk. I can't just walk across your land at any old time, but it has to be done in such a way that's acceptable to you and provides public access to the thing. So this is kind of the system. It just recognizes the fact that we have all have an interest in that, in this society, right? And I don't know how that has managed to survive in a place which, you know, as you say, also pretty from Thatcher on, glorified private property in everything, but that's certainly...
Maybe it's a historical vestige of the fact that, you know, England had common lands and so on,
yes,
where in this country, from the beginning, well, we had this big frontier, so it wasn't felt as an issue for a while. But there was always the feeling that you'll just take your stake and then you own it, and there probably wasn't as much of a history of common lands. I'm sort of half making this up, but that may be a reason for the difference.
Amongst Western settlers, yes, and I don't know about, you know, Latin America, but certainly, but the Native Americans held their resources in common, right?
Yeah, but they how have they done with the invasion of the rest of us. I want to do one last thing that I'll read so I can give time for Sue to do her thing. I'll just sort of end, as I promised Marty to do, with like what I like to call the A-hold rant. Okay, A-hold being a corporation. So if I had put my images up, but I can just describe them. It's fine. So consider a local phenomenon to me, just an illustration of what George is talking about in my personal life. There's the old Saks building and parking lot in Millburn, New Jersey. Where I lived in Millburn for a while, now I moved it one town over, but I pass it all the time. It's about 18 miles from here. It's a large lot. There's the old vacant Saks Fifth Avenue building in Millburn, New Jersey. There's a large, vacant lot, and it's been standing there vacant for at least 24 years, if not more. Recently, speaking of arrogance, okay, I'm reading my own thing now. You know, so, recently, aware that this property had always intrigued me, if only on George's grounds, and knowing that the date for this talk was coming up, I took it on myself to do a little research. Really, it was a little research. I just Googled about the property. A search phrase of Saks Fifth Avenue building, Millburn, New Jersey, or the like, turned up some links, and those links led to others, and pretty soon this picture emerged. It seems that the property has, for at least the last 24 years or so, been owned by a company called the Ahold Corporation, which is a European conglomerate that owns, I assume, among other things, supermarket chains.
Yes, so.
And for at least some of that time, if not all of it, development of the property has been tied up in a kind of three or four cornered wrangling between Ahold, the townships of Milburn and Springfield, because it's sort of near the border, and somewhat but not entirely Sotto Voce, King's Supermarket in Milburn. Seems that Ahold has been desirous of putting up a supermarket on the property. The people of Milburn and Springfield, or perhaps the developers among them who attend town board meetings, are against that use of the property. King's is against that use of the property because that would compete with them. And so nothing has been done. But I say to you, 24 years, every so often someone, a town resident, will look at the vacant property. Now, let me step aside. This is a large, this is a settled area, you know, densely settled suburb of New York and New Jersey. Rents, land values, house costs are pretty high there. And the use of land is pretty, you know, pretty intense, mostly for residential, somewhat for commercial. And if we had the image up, you would see this big, you know, for that area, space, and you're not allowed to do anything. You could use it for park. Well, let me go on. Every so often, someone, a town resident, will look at the vacant property and propose to the town or anyone who will listen, why don't we at very least use the place for parking? Let's do something with it. There's a parking shortage in town. And they might well also add spaces tight in Milburn and goes at a premium, whether for residential or commercial purposes. A lot of that size, that centrally located, represents a lot of use, a lot of access to land, if you will. And the holding of it out of use inevitably forces would-be users of that land, whether shoppers or residents or office space users, that much further out. At the same time, and for that very reason, it keeps the cost of the land, the use of land in Milburn, already high, that much higher than it would otherwise be. But as I well know, and as a real estate lawyer in the offices I used to share, reminded me when I discussed the situation with her, there's nothing the town can do to force Ahold to sell the property. That's the law. Ahold owns it. A few years of wrangling, I could understand. That happens. A small space, who cares? But that much space and 24 years, there's no excuse for it. An explanation, in my view, my guess is that at this point, this can only be land speculation, a guess, an explanation at best, but no excuse. In any event, you do not have to know the first thing about political economy to know that there is a serious sin against the public interest being committed here in keeping that much property in that location that long out of use. And here I might have written, end rant. Okay, so that's a thing. And it's just every time I pass it, it's just decades, nothing done. And you know that's, you don't have to be a Georgist to know that there's a sin in that. People, you know, the community needs to use that land. So I could end it there if you, unless you want to chime in, because Sue's like champing at the bit. She's been very nice, but I can feel the vibe here. She's just ready to, am I right? I'm right, yeah.
Well, I'm a little nervous about the time.
That's okay, no, we got, you got like a half an hour.
No.
Or close to.
25
minutes.
Right, but I want to leave time for people to
okay. All right.
Talk.
Yeah. All right.
I want to do all of it.
Okay. Yeah, you've had to listen to me long enough.
You're nice to listen to, though.
Can we see the screen, or should we dim the light?
Yeah. Oh, we have to dim the light.
Donald, are you okay? Can you see it?
Yes,
I need to dim the light.
Not too well.
All right. We're going to be in the dark.
Could someone help me with the computer?
I can stand there.
And I'll just tell you when to do it. Yeah.
You're going to get the light, or shall I?
Okay. But you guys should come out here so you can.
Okay.
Just nod to me.
You might want to come
on. No, I'm fine.
You okay?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Thanks.
Okay. if anyone starts having trouble seeing it, just let me know. Okay. So I'm Sue Peters, and I've been studying our monetary system for, I don't know, maybe like 9 years, 10 years. And I've given a lot of public talks about it because it's one of those things like the knowledge that Henry George offers that's not taught in our schools and is actively actually kept out of our schools. So it has been for the last 100 years. Okay, and I'm just going to give you a handout which will give you some ways to get more information. If you're interested, you have this time. You I was going to give it to Maury. Okay. Okay, so I'm going to give a talk on Henry George's, what he understood about money. And it's based on a paper. Part of it is based on a paper by Stephen Zoellander, who passed away last year, who started the American Monetary Institute, which was instrumental in having Dennis Kucinich put a bill into Congress called the NEED Act in 2010-2011 to take the power of commercial banks to create and issue our money and take it away from them and give it back to the Congress where the Constitution says it should be. So, land value and the money power. Money power is the power to create and issue what we use as money in this country. That's the power. Okay, next. So, I want to talk first about Henry George and the role of government. Next. So, in Social Problems, Henry George defined the first and main purpose of government. He said, and this is a quote, "It is to secure to men those equal and inalienable rights with which the Creator has endowed them. The first of these inalienable rights is the equal right to land." So, that's the purpose of government. Next. He also continues with the cooperative functions of government. So he says, and this is a quote, "As society develops in obedience to that law of integration and increasing complexity, it becomes necessary in order to secure equality that other regulations should be made and enforced, which may be called cooperative functions." Okay, so the government's role in regulation. Next. And here he adds to the function of government that to regulate and establish monopolies. And Steve mentioned that in his talk. And this is another quote. "The concentration that results as society," and that's me, "as society gets more complicated, operates more and more to the restriction and exclusion of competition and to the establishment of complete monopolies." And of course, when Henry George was living in New York, the development of monopolies was going on full tilt in the United States. Quote, "The primary purpose of government being to secure the natural rights and equal liberty of all. All businesses that involve monopoly are within the necessary province of governmental regulation. And businesses that are in their nature complete monopolies become properly functions of the state." Next. So, he was a greenbacker. He understood money. He understood it as a something determined in law. And he recognized the money creation privilege. And back when George was living after the Civil War, the concepts about money creation and the control of the power to issue money was very evident to Americans. You had the whole populist movement, the whole Farmers Alliance, all greenbacks, they understood that this monopoly of creation of the money we all depended on, this had to be part, you know, controlled by our government, not by private parties. And it was really one of the major issues in our elections in the late 1800s. You had various different Greenback Party, Greenback Labor Party. It was in the consciousness of people. They understood. You know, most of the people were farmers. They knew what happens when their land is, you know, the bank takes away their land, or they can't, well, whatever, you know. That understanding in our populace has been taken away, and it actively taken away. And I'll just, I don't know if it's in here, but I'll just say one example that I found last year. It was just a few months ago. I did a panel in Madison, Wisconsin with a group of women who are monetary reformers. And one of them works for Illinois State University. She teaches teachers. And she, you know, she's very well read, and she picked up this 2-volume history of the American high school. And she's reading it, and then she comes across this description, the very well sourced 2-volume history. So in 1894, the National Education Association decided they were going to come together and decide what was going to be taught in American high schools, because the high schools are becoming more populous. Well, let's see what they need to learn. So they had different committees for different subjects. So they had a committee for political economy and subjects like that. There were 10 people on the committee. One of them taught history at Princeton. His name was Woodrow Wilson. At the time, he was like 36 years old or something. So he proposed, he said, oh, we should not teach political economy in our high schools. The students would never be able to understand it. And they voted unanimously to keep it out of our high schools. So now I can look at students today, and I know they're clueless about how the world really works. You know, it's been, and, you know, they do that. They're clueless about how the money works. They're clueless about how wealth is created, what creates wealth, you know. But it's an active process of not wanting people to know. Okay. So Henry George said back then, it is the business of government to issue money. By leaving to them, the private banks, even in part and under restrictions and guarantees, the issuance of money, the people of the United States suffer. You can't even leave them 1%. You left them 1% of that power. They slowly, over time, would get, you know, buy back everything else. The loss of millions of dollars sensibly increase the influences. The influences which exert a corrupting effect upon their government. When the Bank of England was created, public, it was a public bank, they called it the Bank of England, so that it was a private bank, but the people who put it together and went to the Parliament for the charter, you can find the sources, that, you know, they said, no, we're not going to call it a corporation. No, people don't like that. This is 1694. Right? People don't like the word corporation, don't use that. And we'll call it Bank of England because that sounds like very, you know, part of the government. Well, it wasn't. They got the power to create and issue money from their charter, from Parliament. First thing they did was the money they created, they walked into Parliament and they bribed the parliamentarians, because Parliament is the only power that could take the power away from them, because it's in the charter from Parliament. So let's make sure that they're never going to take the power away from us. And of course, that goes on in our Congress today. I don't know how wittingly or unwittingly the representatives and senators are. So most of them, they probably don't understand the money power, you know. But certainly money has a certain, you know, influence on what they consider doing. And anyway, okay, I have a lot of stories, but I want to get on to this. Okay, next. Okay, so he recognized, Henry George recognized, that money is an abstract social power embedded in the law. And this is from the Science of Political Economy. It is important that this purely representative character of money should be thoroughly understood and constantly kept in mind. For, from the confusion resulting from the confounding of money with wealth, has flown the largest and most pernicious results. Right? So we know in the room, all wealth is a product of labor upon land. Right? But here, what, you know, we think, oh, we need money. That's wealth. They've got to get more and more money, you know. And money is really simply a ticket, or should be really a ticket, to get wealth, not wealth itself. Next. Henry George recognized that the private money power actively confused the nature of money and wealth to keep the power in private hands. So in the Science of Political Economy, the confusion of the term is one of the effects of the influence upon thought of the same special interests. They know, they have the power, and they want to keep it, so they know how to make that happen. Next. Okay. Oh, and this is what I was telling you. It is in here. And this is Richard Crookes, C-R-U-G, two-volume history of high school curriculum. Next. It's so interesting. In this current book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, everything your American history textbook got wrong. You know, it's a very good book. It's an excellent book. There's no mention of the Federal Reserve. There's no mention of the money. It's got great information in it, but nothing about the money.
Well, they're waiting for you to write more lies.
And nothing about Henry George. Okay. So, but that's a little bit about Henry George's really advanced view of money, of the abstract nature of money, of that it should be the power to create an issue. It needs to be with the government because it's a monopoly for everybody's life. It determines a lot of the quality of our lives. Not totally, but a lot. Okay. So I just want to say, oh, can you go back, Maury?
Yeah.
Just go back. I just want to spend a little more time, maybe 5 more minutes, on looking at the impact of this private money system on real estate development in New York City, and basically on the creation of city debt. That's sort of, I just want to mention something about New York City, and I know you you like de Blasio, but but the amount of debt that New York is currently in, I'm talking about all the bonds that have been sold by the city to all these creditors. In 2002, and I think it's in here, 2002, the total city bond debt was around $56 billion. It's now $116 billion in 15 years, greater than 100% doubled. Now, I know a lot of that was Bloomberg, but it's still going up. You know.
You said billion or million?
Billion.
Billion.
How does that compare to the rate of inflation?
I don't know.
It's probably not that different.
It's the amount of the bonds.
No, I understand, but you know, if inflation is even averaging through that period 3%, you're going to get there too.
Can you explain that? What do you mean?
Just the time value of money. You know, if over 15, there, you know, the rule of 72.
Yes.
Okay, so at approximately a 7% return, money's going to double in 10 years.
Well, we have 100% more money doubling.
So half of 7%, you know, it's probably going to double in about 15 years. You know, it's
really, I don't know what the average rate of inflation was over the 15 years, but if it's in the area of 3%, we're probably not so out of whack.
I guess what I don't understand is, say there's no inflation.
Well, if there's no inflation, yes, then you can say legitimately the debt doubled in spending power in terms. But if you incorporate inflation, it's the spending power is more or less equivalent to what it was 15 years ago.
Well, I don't know. It's taking more funds out of our revenue in New York City.
Okay, I don't want to belabor the point.
That could go to other things. You know. Okay, next. Okay, so the monopoly of the creation and issuance of money, which is in the hands of private banks, is used to cripple our governments at all levels with their debt. The interest of all this debt goes to the banks. So this is it. So the fiscal year 2017, the city debt was $116 billion. It grew 107% since 2002. Okay, the debt grew that much. And the city service, the debt service cost, which is what comes out of our yearly taxes before the tax money is spent for our city needs, is about 11% now of our budget, which is a lot.
And the alternative is a public bank?
No, the alternative is something equivalent to the MEAD Act in the Congress. This is not just our city that's having a problem. It's the whole nation is under the thumb of this monopoly.
Am I right to guess the MEAD Act did not pass?
It didn't come out of committee.
Right.
And Dennis Kucinich got redistricted out of the Congress. Yeah, that's what they do. Okay, next. Oh, so this is just to show. So here, is this is 2002, $56 billion, and now we're up there, $116 billion in 2017. It's pretty wild. Next. Who buys the city's debt? Okay, so the city issues bonds. Different parts of the agencies of the city issue the bonds. Who buys it? Next. Underwriters. Who are underwriters? Next. Underwriters make profit from the difference between the buy and sell. So they'll buy the bonds from the city, give the city the money, and then they'll sell them to their customers, or they might keep them on their books. You know, they might keep them as assets. Next. Oh, they make fees too every time they buy bonds and sell them. So a lot of the underwriters are Federal Reserve member banks. These are some of the banks that buy the general obligation bonds of New York City, which are of all the different types of bonds, that's the biggest bulk of them. So you have Morgan Stanley, Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, JP Morgan, Citigroup, Barclays, Goldman Sachs, PNC, Royal Bank of Canada, Wells Fargo, there's my bank, TD Bank, that's the one I bank in, that's there. Bank in New York, Deutsche Bank, which is part of the New York Fed, even though they're a German bank, HSBC, US Bank Corp. So these banks, which have the power to create and issue money. When they buy those bonds from the city, they create and issue the money and buy the bonds. It's as simple as that. They don't have to go and find the money from anywhere. They're banks.
I'm sorry to be contrary here.
That's okay.
But if the underwriters are buying the debt that's already created by the city, they're not creating it. They're just middlemen to find the ultimate owner of it.
No, they're buying the debt from the city.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And then remarketing it to their clients.
Yes.
Right? But they're not creating the debt. They're not, it's the city that created the debt. the underwriters are just redistributing it.
I think of it more as the city printed up the bonds and then said, I'm selling them, who wants to buy them to get the money?
But the bond itself is the debt, right? That's the promise to pay the interest rate and
that's the legal document.
Yeah, that's the debt. The underwriters are just taking it in because they feel like they have the clients they can redistribute it to.
But where's the transfer of the money?
When they buy the debt.
Yeah, and where's the money coming from?
Ultimately, it's coming from the public that the underwriters sell it to.
Right.
They're just acting as middlemen. And like any middleman, they take a fee, right?
But when they buy that debt from the city, I don't know how you want to say, they're creating, they're using their money power to create the money and buy that.
I don't see that.
Are you saying that the banks print money?
They're making loans, right?
Print meaning in the computer, in accounts.
They're creating money out of nothing?
Yes.
Well, go ahead and I'm ready for your comment.
No, I don't have to talk the whole time.
No, I mean, you're the guy. I will confess that I am impressively ignorant about the monetary system, as I can prove by my bank account balance. So
you must have gone to a U.S. school to stay on teaching.
Well, no, I think even if I were schooled, it would still be true. But I would have been out that day. But what I'm confused about is even more primary than what Steve was asking about, which is my understanding of bonds is that it's a creation of, there's a loan that goes on. Something along those lines. The public is buying bonds on the, so they're the creditors giving money to the city in return for the city's, for their belief that the city will pay it back with, you know, some return on the investment.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand why that is fundamentally bad for the public. I mean, I could see where it's bad if the city either defaults or is fraudulent in the issuance of those bonds, sort of bilking the public, but you haven't mentioned that. So I also don't see the relationship between that and what I think of as money, the most convenient medium of exchange for wealth. So I'm like multiply confused. I'm sorry.
That's okay. No, this is
all right. I just didn't want to remember. We got 2 minutes.
Oh.
Okay.
If you can answer that in 60 seconds, go
okay.
ahead.
Okay. You remember what you said.
I'm confused about the relationship between bonds and money.
Okay.
Right.
Let me just
What's bad about having private? Are you saying that banks privately issue money in some way, and if so, I'm not seeing how that's happening with your example.
Okay.
Sorry.
So you have the city printing up bonds and wanting to sell them because they need the money.
Right.
Right. According to city law, the bonds have to be sold to the underwriters, and then they sell them to the public. It's similar to, I don't know if you know anything about our 12 Federal Reserve banks. Right? But according to the law, right, when our government, the federal government, issues, prints up a bond and wants to sell it to the public, they go in and sell it to primary bank dealerships, which are members of the Fed. They have to go through this conduit of always going to the banks, and the banks, they're going to create money to give it to the government, and they're going to charge fees, right? But it's always going through them, and then it gets to the public.
So am I right to guess that your beef with this is that the banks are making a profit at the expense of the public in a way that you think is wrong? Is that what you're saying?
No, my beef is that they have this monopoly to create our money.
But what's the economic
But when it comes to public debt, like you're describing, be it federal debt or city debt or whatever, whatever.
Yeah.
The banks did not create that.
The debt?
The government created that at whatever level we're talking about.
But who bought their debt?
You're saying the role of the bank is little bank.
Yeah, I mean, who bought the debt is irrelevant. The debt is created by the government that spent it on whatever they decided was worth spending
it on. If you create a debt, that's not money. It's just a piece of paper. You have to have the money that you want to spend. Right?
All right, let me ask another question. Let's say I'm a small businessman.
Yes.
And I want to start a business. But I can't fund it myself, so I need to take a loan. Are you saying that I should be going to the government to get the loan?
No. You should go to a bank. But the bank should not have the money to create, the power to create that money and give it to you.
But
because you know why? Let me just say. Because they're deciding to create the money and give it to the weapons manufacturer.
Okay, wait.
Wait a minute, let me finish. And they're deciding to create that money and give it to those multinational corporations who are overseas. They are having this incredible monopoly power to create and issue our money.
Well, but who... So in using my example, I'm not a weapons manufacturer, okay? I just want to start, like, you know, a dry cleaner or some business that I can't fund out of my own pocket. I need
right.
startup capital, okay?
Right.
So if I go to a bank,
yeah,
they look at my business plan and they say, okay, we'll take a chance on you, and they give me the loan.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
You're saying they shouldn't be able to do that?
I'm saying they shouldn't have the power to create the money in that moment and give it to you.
Well, who should?
They should have money in the bank that they loan to you. And that money in the bank, all of the money in the bank, of all of our banks, all of our money supply, should originally be created.
So there should be no debt money at all?
What do you mean by debt money?
Well, there's currency, which remains in the power of the government
right.
to create, you know, the coins and bills.
Well,
and
just,
stuff, but
just the coins.
Well, the bills, too. But also, there's debt money, which is loans issued in anticipation of being repaid by economic activity.
Issued by who?
Issued by banks.
All right, created and issued, right?
Well, but create... You know, if I want to start this business,
yeah,
it's not the bank alone that's just willy-nilly creating it. I'm having a viable business plan that
well,
I'm presenting.
Well, they can turn you down.
Of course they can. But if they decide to have some faith in my business acumen, they'll make the loan.
They'll create and issue the money.
Right.
They do it.
Right, but what's wrong with that?
You don't do it. You might have a desire for the need.
Well, how do I fund myself without a bank? That's what I'm getting at. If you want to take the bank out of that equation...
No, I'm not. I'm saying leave the bank, but take away from the bank the power to create and issue the money. Let them have their power, their expertise of saying, here's money already existing in my bank, and I'm going to lend that money to you.
I'm going to jump in here and just say that this is a good demonstration, because it will take more time to sort this out, good demonstration of the importance... that George would maybe agree with, of defining terms. Because
yes.
I think part of the confusion, which I'm sure eventually we can sort out, is what you mean when you say money and how that relates to this essentially contractual arrangements, business deal that we're talking about, which is debt. So those are fundamental terms to the discussion. And in order to get clarity and mutual understanding, we would have to sort through that, but we don't have time.
No, you're right. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, we got a new panel at 5 minutes.
Okay. Oh, yeah. We have to get to work.
Let's give a round of applause.